today on Against the Grain. You lose a son to street violence, and you grieve, but there's so much else going on because you're poor, you're black, and you're up against racial bias and a set of tropes surrounding black males, black families, and African-American mothers. I'm CS. Ina Kelleher has been looking into what she calls the emotional labor required of black mothers and the social and political context of their grief and their lives. She joins me coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If black lives matter, then what about the lives of black mothers, African-American women who've lost their children to urban violence? Well, what they're going through matters a great deal, even though the focus when people get killed, when an African-American man is murdered in the inner city, is, if the media focuses on it at all, is on who was killed and who killed him. Ina Kelleher has chosen to focus on the politics of grief, the grief belonging to and expressed by mothers who have to, in a sense, perform in front of the media and the public in order to garner sympathy and support, and to establish her dead child as undeserving of his death in the face of racist assumptions. This process, this project of proving one's child's humanity and worth, takes a tremendous toll, says Ina Kelleher, who is writing a dissertation based on extensive interviews with black women who have lost children to street violence. Ina, who is a PhD student in comparative ethnic studies at UC Berkeley, recently joined me in studio, and I asked her what happened to 16-year-old Darion Albert on Chicago's South Side on September 24th, 2009.
Darion was leaving his high school, Finger High School, and he got caught up in a brawl with several other young men who had lived in his neighborhood or were from nearby communities. So the surrounding areas are Englewood, Roseland, and Altgeld Gardens, who, you know, historically there have been tensions, whether you want to call it, you know, gang rivalry or, you know, turf wars, but there's tension because of the, you know, housing projects in Altgeld Gardens versus the kind of more long-term residents on the South Side. And due to a recent turnover of Finger High School, which meant, you know, due to underperformance, the school was closed and reopened. And with that, a new administration was put in place, many new teachers, and simultaneously, a nearby high school was turned into a military academy. So students from the surrounding area who did not want to attend military academy now had to go to school at Finger with, you know, members of community members who they had had, you know, tensions with or kind of historical feuding with. And so, you know, on that day when Darion was leaving school, he got kind of involved in this fight where he was beaten to death with pieces of railroad, so like long wooden planks, like 8x4s, and the hit to his head is what actually took his life.
And was it a question of several young men ganging up on Darion, or was it kind of a free-for-all and it just happened that Darion was killed?
If you look at the footage of the fight, it is extremely chaotic. You'll see, you know, scores of young people kind of leaving school, running in and out of the frame, screams, and you see many young men, maybe like 6 to 8, and then slowly some of the young men who were fighting rush out of the frame, and then we see Darion being beaten by this one particular man. But no, it wasn't an act of bullying. When I spoke to his mother, Anjanette, she actually said that part of the fighting that had occurred was because of, you know, a conflict involving a young lady, a sort of like romantic brawl. And so, you know, it's very interesting to kind of think about the fight as also an expression of, you know, masculinity and of, you know, masculine aggression in the midst of, you know, a community that was undergoing severe joblessness, rampant poverty, lack of resources. So Darion had been participating in the fight. That's what witnesses said. And unfortunately, unlike the other men, his life was taken.
And his assailants were also African American?
Yes. So Eugene Bailey, Sylvanus Shannon, and Eugene Colbert were the young men who were found guilty. And they had been students at Finger or previous students at Finger. None of them had had any kind of criminal background before the fight. Many of them, like Darion, had grown up in these neighborhoods. Many of them also had come from single-parent homes and actually had lives that were quite similar to Darion. And they shared similar interests, like basketball, going to church with their family, and similar sort of aspirations of going to college and sort of middle-class aspirations of leaving poverty and the inner city. The intention was not to kill him, but it is what happened because of the force of the blow.
Now, when covering events like this, the media tend to focus on who was killed and who did the killing. Why were you motivated to investigate what the victim's mother, Anne Jeanette, what she was going through after her son's death?
I think at the time I was working in Chicago as a youth advocate for a nonprofit where I worked very closely with young people in improving their academics, in applying to college, also in sort of, you know, helping them move through all the normal trials and tribulations of adolescence that was, of course, compounded by living in poverty, living in the midst of racism and segregated public schooling. And what struck me in the coverage of the Darion Albert murder was what I felt was sort of this, you know, sinister depiction and exploitation of Anne Jeanette's grief. You saw so many images of this woman just crying and weeping and wailing. And I remember it still to this day, like, kind of sends shivers down my spine. And to be, you know, kind of absorbing and consuming those kinds of images of maternal grief, there was something that just didn't sit right with me. On the one hand, you know, of course, we can all relate to that feeling of loss, of desperation, of very palpable sorrow. But the images again and again of Black suffering, both the images of the fight, right, the sort of lynching of a young man, but also juxtaposed with the images of his mother crying, there seemed to be a close relationship between those two things. And I wanted to understand more. And the idea of Anne Jeanette having to navigate, you know, what we all know can be a very aggressive, you know, media while processing the loss of her child, I couldn't bear to think about that. And so I, of course, wanted to understand what that was like for her. At the same time, you know, in my work, I am working with real people. And so I have to be very cognizant of giving them time and space to process, you know, on their own terms. And that's why, you know, I always choose to engage with families who've had several years to kind of digest what has happened. And by no means does this mean that they have moved on or are healed, but it does provide a little bit of distance.
So how many years after Darion's murder did you approach Anne Jeanette and have conversations with her, interviews with her?
I first reached out to her in 2013. So that was about 4 years after the fact. And, you know, her demeanor in that initial encounter was, you know, very kind of meek, you know, quiet, very sorrowful. And then as the years went on and we became closer and closer, I could just see, you know, what an empowered woman she was. I, you know, bore witness to her anger and her very justified anger at what had happened to her son and what had happened to her family, and also her humor. You know, she's an incredibly humorous woman. And so that transformation, you know, from how she had been received by outsiders in the past, the kind of character that she had to put on for outsiders to kind of be able to have her story be received and held and seen as, you know, worthy of attention, and then how she was able to kind of come out of that shell and be more herself. Of course, you know, the academic, you know, research and the academic interview is another kind of performance in and of itself. So, you know, I'm not trying to argue that this is sort of a pure encounter, but certainly it has shifted a lot throughout the years.
Ina Kelleher joins me in studio. She is a PhD student in comparative ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And we are talking about a paper she recently presented at the annual conference of the National Association for Ethnic Studies. Her paper is called Policing Memory, The Violence of Making Black Maternal Grief Legible. And that paper is a part of the dissertation she's working on at UC Berkeley. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you write that Anjanette became the speaking authority on the character of her son, the moral character of her son. What did Anjanette see as her task? What did she feel like she had to prove her son to be what kind of person?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the assumption is when a young man is killed violently is that he was involved in the street life or was a gang member. And right away, Anjanette felt that she had to prove that her son was a good person, was a law-abiding citizen, a young man who wanted to have a normal life, which consisted of, you know, going to college, getting married, having children, being a productive citizen. And so, like many mothers I have interviewed, Anjanette set out right away to prove that, you know, this was a tragedy and not just more of the same, that her son didn't deserve to die. Although, of course, that's what most people would assume just by virtue of his race, his gender, and where he happened to be at the time of the murder. You know, in interviews with mainstream reporters, she was asked time and again, you know, what kind of person was Darian? And almost always she would answer, he was an honor student. So that term, honor student, is code for a good boy, a person who plays by the rules and works hard and, you know, is doing everything that they can to achieve the American dream. She set out to do that, and the media facilitated that by doing interviews in her home, in her living room, with a backdrop of, you know, a Christmas tree or family portraits. So you get this very homey feeling in these interviews, and Anjanette plays the part of, you know, the grieving mother. And that, of course, stood out in stark contrast to, you know, the times that I would spend with her in her home and the kind of chaos that ensues when tragedy hits any family. When you're dealing with intense grief and sorrow, the dishes aren't the priority, right? You're trying to survive day to day. And so, you know, she would often talk about, you know, the stress of having rodents in the house, the threat of homelessness because she couldn't make her rent because Darian's murder had caused her to have PTSD, intense depression, anxiety. She found it incredibly difficult to attain and stay in a job. At the same time, she had all the pressures of raising her daughter, Raya, who is now a senior in high school. And, you know, it's not as though, okay, I lost one child and now I can kind of just stop and grieve that. At the same time, she had to kind of do all the same sort of mothering and caregiving that she had to do all along with her daughter. And although there are, you know, difficulties in raising a young man in the inner city, there are a whole other set of problems when raising a young woman. And so that was a real source of inner turmoil and conflict for her. And that kind of image or facade of this perfect, respectable, middle-class home really fell away when I actually spent time with her. And you could see that she was struggling with just making ends meet.
She was also struggling with, or maybe confiding with you about the complexity that was her son, that really is any human being. Darian, she represented to the media and to the public from whom she was hoping to gain sympathy. She represented him as an honor student, as a good kid. What did she tell you about her relationship with Darian and what kind of young man he was?
It's so interesting. When I do these interviews with mothers, there's, I don't know what the name is for it, but there's this kind of this sorrowful laughter of remembrance. Like she would laugh and tell me about Darian. What was he like? She would kind of laugh and she would say, well, he was a pretty good kid. You know, we had our ups and downs and stuff. And she even said to me, you know, when he got a little bit taller than me, I think he thought he was my brother, my big brother or something. So she talked about this, you know, very familiar sort of push and pull with teenagers around authority and who's the parent and who's the child and what can you tell them to do and not tell them to do. But always she would go back to, you know, even if I knew that I was going to lose my son at such a young age, I would still do it all over again. And my only wish, my only regret is that I didn't do more for him.
Now, you write in this paper that Anjanette joined a long legacy of Black maternal activism. So activism by Black mothers, often low-income Black mothers. What should we know about how African-American maternal suffering has been deployed over time for political purposes?
Black maternal activism is an incredibly effective mode of resistance and political organizing for a number of reasons. One, you know, historically, Black women have been shut out of the institution of motherhood and mothering. So enslaved Black women didn't have the right to raise their children and call them their own. They were sold off as chattel. And so by reaffirming that, yes, I am a mother, and it hurts me to see my child in pain, their humanity, as well as the humanity of their child, is exposed and is brought to the forefront because, you know, systematically it is denied so often, time and again. And while you're right with like a figure like Sojourner Truth, who in her speech, Ain't I a Woman, spoke about the pain she felt in seeing all 13 children of hers sold to slavery, we have other examples of more kind of respectable Black middle-class femininity who have also been, you know, historical figures in the movement for Black emancipation. And one of these figures is Mamie Till Bradley, who, you know, fought to have her son, Emmett, who is brutally murdered by a white supremacist, having his body, his casket open and his body exposed to show what white supremacists were continuing to do in the South to Black people. And so Mamie, Sojourner Truth, so many other Black women have used their mourning and used their sorrow to expose state-sanctioned violence and racism. And it's very effective because, you know, in U.S. history, there's a real disdain for political activism, for this kind of more aggressive, more masculinist mode of resistance. You know, you think of protesters with signs or with stones, you know, who go to the front lines to fight for justice. You know, maternal suffering is a little bit more subversive in that it uses a sort of more gentle, a more... you know, people might think of it as this kind of weakness as strength. You know, we're not here as activists to kind of, you know, cause trouble. We're here because an injustice was done. Our home, our hearth, where we belong, right, in a patriarchal society has been disrupted unfairly. And we've had to come out to the streets because, you know, this injustice has occurred. But once this is dealt with, once justice is served to us and our children, we'll return back to the home. Now, whether or not they actually will is another question, right? But it's in a very effective way to kind of, you know, take over a public platform without being dismissed as just radical subversives who don't want the best for society, who want to, you know, cause trouble and not keep the peace.
Yeah, the mother presents herself as a nurturer, which is what she is or was, not as an activist, not as someone who might threaten the society or the system, even though she might have a political message and a very sharp one.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Anjanette just refusing to stop grieving publicly is a form of resistance because the fact that Darren was murdered is not actually that unique for young Black men on the South Side of Chicago. It's very rare that a summer goes by and we don't see the coverage of hundreds and hundreds of murders. And so refusing to stop, you know, to refusing to let the sort of cultural amnesia around racialized violence is an act of resistance because she says, you know, my child's life mattered. He will not be forgotten. And there's a number of ways in which she does this. One way is through this kind of public memorial, like the street sign. She's fought, you know, with her local alderman for years to have the street where Darren was murdered named after him. And this raises this whole other set of political dilemmas for, you know, the local political structure in Chicago, because they say back to her, well, although we care for your son and he was a good boy and played by the rules, what are we going to say to all the other mothers who've lost their children? Are we going to have every street named after a kid in Chicago? So then again, we see how, you know, racism disrupts this idea that grief and loss is a sort of universal experience. Because for young Black men, they're seen as one of many, right? Another statistic. Even when their mothers try to kind of memorialize their individual legacies, they're reminded that, well, you're not so special. There's so many more. And so there's this flattening of individual complexity and an individual right to have your life honored.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ina Kelleher joins me. She is a graduate student in Comparative Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. And her dissertation project examines how grief and mourning are experienced and performed both publicly and privately by mothers who lose their children to urban violence. What Anjanette was doing, what she felt she had to do, was what you call policing memory. What's that?
Policing memory is a phenomenon that I've observed in the field whereby individuals from highly criminalized communities have to kind of dispel racist assumptions that they were deserving of whatever violent event took their life, and prove their humanity and worth to public audiences. So mothers like Anjanette will, you know, although the news coverage might point to their son being involved in the street life or being a gang member, they have to kind of show that, no, he was an honor student, he attended church, he was a good boy, he did his chores, as a way to kind of offset the assumption that their violent murder happened because they were deserving of it, because they were involved in some kind of criminal or delinquent behavior.
Yeah, and what kind of toll did that take, this public performance in which she presented an image of her son that didn't quite accord, as you were saying earlier, with what she told you privately about Darian, that he, you know, that there were issues, that they did have some conflicts in their relationship. He wasn't the perfect kid. And no, there's, of course, no one's a perfect kid. What kind of toll did that take on her, this talking to the public in one way and feeling like she can't reveal certain things about her son to them, and having her own feelings about a child she knows in a much deeper way than she's presenting?
The effect of having to perform this respectable form of Black maternal grief was intense isolation. Anjanette was flooded with requests for, you know, public appearances on the media. And on the one hand, she saw it as an opportunity to have her son's life honored and remembered. But on the other hand, she became acutely aware of what parts of herself and her son she had to hide for fear of jeopardizing their legal case, for fear of jeopardizing their access to funds to help them with the costs of, let's say, the funeral. And so right away, she learned that, you know, she had to hide the fact that she had been incarcerated for a time because she had been defending herself against an abusive boyfriend. She was told by her lawyers, should that information get out, we'll lose the whole case. You know, all those hours, time, money that we spent fighting for your son, it'll all be gone. Because once the public had a sense that she was maybe not such a good mother, then she would be blamed for what had happened to Darian. That, you know, she had said to me, if they're thinking, well, if, you know, I'm out here acting crazy in the streets, no wonder that her son is out here acting crazy in the streets. So she feared that people would judge her son based on how good a mother she was, meaning, you know, how much she abided by social norms.
And again, we're talking about Anjanette, who is the mother of a 16-year-old boy, Darian Albert, who was killed in a fight involving other African-American young men on Chicago's South Side in September of 2009. And my guest, Ina Kelleher, has spoken extensively in private, has interviewed Anjanette to help her, help Ina understand what this woman was going through and how her private opinions may have differed from her public ones. What do you make of this binary, Ina, of good kids, bad kids, which Anjanette was clearly appealing to as she tried to present an acceptable, a quote, acceptable image of her son to the public?
I think, unfortunately, continuing to rely on, you know, these categories of good kid, bad kid, honor student, gangbanger, I think it continues to oversimplify the very complex realities of inner city youth. And I think, actually, those two kind of caricatures reinforce each other. And we saw this in the case of Darion, as he was kind of softened into this honor student, this perfect young man, his assailants were hardened into these ruthless criminals, into what the media called savages. When in fact, you know, if you look at the legal transcript, they had family members testify to their, you know, good characters, to this was a terrible mistake they had made, totally out of the ordinary for them, that they too aspired to go to college, to go to prom, to have normal kind of teenage lives. And I think that if we can set aside these kind of caricatures and look at the very complex, you know, everyday lives of inner city youth and their families, we see that actually there's quite a bit of interplay. Prudence Carter has this idea, this notion of cultural straddlers, how there are young people who can both, you know, be very scholastically successful and also be very involved in the street life. So, you know, we see that by focusing on these kind of the moral integrity of people instead of the structures that shape their lives and the ways in which they use their agency and work around the constraints they're presented to make meaning of their lives, to live as good a life as possible, we run the risk of, you know, really missing the point entirely, which is, you know, how do people make it with the limitations that they're living in?
Well, speaking of structures, Anjanette was clearly familiar with kind of the structural factors, the structural racism that affected how she lived, how Darion lived. Did she bring up race and racism in her interviews with the media?
In her media appearances, Anjanette never brings up race or racism or poverty. You know, in her media interviews, she'll kind of call for these sort of vague coming togethers of community against violence, coming together around, you know, safe passages to school, these sort of benign, sort of apolitical sort of campaigns. In private, you know, it was quite the opposite. She spoke about an interaction she had with Father Flager, who's a very well-known Catholic priest in Chicago who also does quite a bit of work against violence and against poverty. She was very hurt by Father Flager when he, instead of approaching her after Darion's murder, he went to her family, whom she saw as kind of being opportunistic about this media attention they were getting around Darion's murder. And she was very hurt that, you know, he kind of believed what they told her about, you know, them being the ones who had raised Darion and them being his primary caregivers. And she attributed, you know, his misstep to his race. And she had told me, you know, all right, well, this is what happened with Father Flager. From now on, I'll just stick with Black people. And that kind of became one way in which she discerned which journalists she would continue to talk to and which ones she wouldn't. Similarly, she spoke fondly of Black leaders who approached her after Darion was murdered to provide monetary support. And she again attributed that to a racial solidarity and understanding of the struggle. So Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, they both provided immediate financial assistance. They both kind of understood the kind of rivalries that can occur within families when these kinds of tragedies occur. And they, you know, use language like we, us, ours to kind of underscore that this was their shared struggle, that she wasn't alone in it, and that they would be fighting, you know, with her, beside her for, you know, a better tomorrow. And so this kind of highlights Michael Dyson's concept of linked faith, whereby African Americans will support Black leadership despite their socioeconomic differences because of this notion of a shared racial pride and struggle and a shared set of political interests by their race alone.
Her name is Ina Kelleher. She is a PhD student in the Comparative Ethnic Studies Department at UC Berkeley. We'll take a short break and speak more to her about her dissertation project about Black maternal grief and mourning in the context often of underserved, poor inner city communities. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ina Kelleher is writing a dissertation in comparative ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And we're focusing on a paper she recently presented at a conference. Her paper is called Policing Memory, The Violence of Making Black Maternal Grief Legible. It's drawn from her dissertation that she's writing about how grief and mourning, often in African-American communities, and specifically by African-American mothers, are experienced and performed. And this grief and mourning is often around the death of a child, which was the case for Anne Jeanette, whose 16-year-old son, Darian Albert, was killed in a fight involving a number of young people on Chicago's South Side. This was back on September 24th, 2009. So Anjanette was really making an effort, a concerted effort, to present Darian as this kind of exceptional, productive person, socially worthwhile, personally worthwhile. Do you think such an effort would have been required if her boy had come from a privileged area and was not Black?
No, I don't believe so. I think that that's one way in which, you know, race really enters the picture in terms of grief and mourning and parental bereavement, is that in the same moment that a parent realizes that their son or daughter has been murdered, they have to quickly think of ways in which to defend themselves against racist assumptions that their child was a delinquent, was a criminal, kind of got what was coming to them.
And what about you mentioned the young men who were part of the activities in which Darian was killed. So how much did the media learn about, and therefore did the public learn about these young men? And do you think they deserved any public sympathy or empathy?
The media almost spent no time interviewing these young men or their families. Originally, when I first conceived of the project, I thought I would be speaking to both families, both, you know, the victims and the assailants. But I found it incredibly difficult to contact the young men who are incarcerated now, who are serving up to 30 years in prison, as well as their families. And I think this is another kind of tragedy. You know, these young men who made a very grave mistake are now, you know, they've now will be spending most of their adult life behind bars. Not to say they can't, you know, find ways of making meaning and finding peace, you know, behind bars. There's something to be said for the ways in which they just disappeared, you know, once they were kind of labeled as guilty, as assailants, as murderers, they stopped being human. And I think that that is so deeply wrong. I'm very interested in understanding for each of these men, what happened that day? What was your life like before that day? You know, I think what we'll find is it wasn't so different from Darian's life. And I think that the only way we're going to understand, you know, why are young people compelled to fight in these ways is by paying attention and asking questions and not kind of deriding them and allowing them to just become monsters that we set off into prisons, into jails. And again, you know, it's not to say there shouldn't be consequences or that there shouldn't be accountability. I'm very interested in ways in which communities can hold their members accountable to, you know, acts of violence. But I certainly simultaneously feel that, you know, allowing these young men to not have a way to make sense of what happened, their actions, and, you know, forgive themselves and ask for forgiveness from Anjanette, I think that's a whole other set of tragedies and is a huge loss of opportunity for us as a society to grow and learn from that. You know, again, I think that gender also played a big part in this. And I think that that's a very underexamined part of, you know, inner city life. The fact that this was a fight about a girl is very interesting to me. You know, what about, let's say, a young woman deciding to date a different young man? What about that is so enraging? What is it about this very public performance of masculine strength that is so important to these young people? I want to understand that. I really do. And unfortunately, there's just not enough attention paid to that. You know, I think it's also not an accident that many of these young men didn't grow up with fathers, didn't grow up with many male teachers or counselors. That I'm interested to learn more about gendered expressions of grief. Why is, let's say, depression or mourning kind of more socially acceptable than rage? You know, perhaps these young men were also crying out because they were going to schools that didn't have enough resources. They didn't have enough going on in their lives to sustain them, to interest them, to help them feel like there was something to live for. For a 16-year-old to have enough strength and anger in their body to murder another person, that says a lot. There's a lot there for us to uncover.
You've referred to some of the tropes, the racist tropes surrounding young black men in inner city areas. What about tropes surrounding African American families and African American mothers that Anjanette might have been aware of and was pushing back against as she was making these public appearances?
Anjanette knew that by being overtly angry and enraged would mean that the audiences that she had would dissipate rapidly because it ushers up images of the black matriarch, the welfare queen, these very racist caricatures of black women and black dysfunctional families that have been circulating, you know, since the 1960s. And so, and as a way to justify the eradication of social services for poor black families. I think that, you know, by appearing demure, by appearing, you know, fragile, Anjanette felt that she could kind of usher in more support from audiences that might otherwise be afraid of, you know, black families, of black communities. It kind of seemed to say like, hey, you know, like it's all safe over here. I'm just a normal mom crying about this tragedy that ensued and not the fact that, you know, both Anjanette and her son grew up around violence their whole lives. Anjanette, you know, has recalled to me many times where she has run from bullets, where she has had to, you know, duck and cover. And she's also had to learn how to defend herself, which was the impetus for her actually being incarcerated, was self-defense in an abusive relationship. But to show that kind of strength, to show that kind of aggressive resistance would mean to kind of disarm her of her humanity in the eyes of mainstream audiences, white audiences.
Anjanette said in at least one news appearance that she wanted to join with other parents to end community violence. So she was appealing to kind of parental unity. Let's get together as parents and do something about this. I don't know whether this was her word, but epidemic of violence. What do you make of that?
I think that as a culture, we are deeply uncomfortable with both grief and rage. And the only way in which to make grief palatable to audiences is to make it productive, meaning, yes, I'm sad. Yes, I'm mourning. Yes, I might be enraged, but I'm going to use this as the impetus for change, for unity, for a better tomorrow. And so knowing that kind of cultural norm of ours, Anjanette appealed to audiences by saying, you know, I'm going to change my sorrow into an opportunity. In private, it was quite the opposite. In private, she, you know, I asked her, you know, what advice would you give other mothers, other parents? And again, she laughed and said, I don't have any advice. I don't know how anybody survives this. All I can tell you is that it's going to be a long road. So get ready. And she just said again and again, you know, I've met so many mothers who are just living in grief. And actually, you know, instead of kind of joining together, she's had to distance herself. She's like, I just get to feel so sad, so depressed that the only way I know I'm going to survive is by getting away from these other mothers and distancing myself, even isolating myself because, you know, I have to keep on living because I have another child to raise.
So in other words, she felt pressure in public to make her son's death part of this narrative of hope and progress.
That's correct, yes.
Ina Kelleher is my guest in studio. She is a PhD student in comparative ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And again, her dissertation looks at how grief and mourning are experienced and performed, both in public and in private, by mothers who lose their children to urban violence. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What about this documentary film? It's called The Interrupters. It came out in 2011. What is that film about, and how prominent is Darian's murder in it?
The Interrupters is a film that follows a handful of violence interrupters who are previous gang members who turn their lives around and work for Ceasefire, an organization that sees violence as an epidemic, and work to stop violence through peaceful mediation. So one of the violence interrupters that is prominently discussed is Amina Matthews. And Amina is shown at the front lines of Darian's murder, consoling Anjanette, walking with Anjanette in vigils, you know, days after he was killed, consoling her. And Darian's murder is one of the key case studies in the film. It was not till after it was released that Anjanette even realized how prominently she was featured in it. At the time that Darian was killed, she vaguely remembered someone with a camera and a microphone asking her, you know, what does Amina mean to you? And she said, oh, well, Amina means the world to me. She's been there for me the whole time, you know, like, and I love her and I care for her and, you know, I'm so grateful for her. And she spoke those words, you know, genuinely, as, you know, this woman has been my friend in my darkest moment and I'm grateful for her love. It was not till after the film came out that she saw that question was posed as a way to kind of highlight Amina's skills as a violence interrupter. And she felt duped. She felt duped and she felt exploited because although the film did very well in award ceremonies and is still used as kind of an educational film around urban violence, you know, she was not a recipient of any of the royalties, wasn't really asked to participate in any of the talks surrounding it. And so she felt kind of, again, that her grief was exploited for the benefit of others.
Now, Ina, you referred earlier to this, but there is the issue of you and this person, in this case, Anjanette, what the dynamics are between the two of you, and she's talking to you in private, and we can assume she's being fairly candid with you, or maybe very candid with you. But, you know, I mean, she could be performing in certain ways in front of an ethnographer, in front of a researcher, in front of an academic like yourself. So how did you go about trying to navigate that and also to figure out the level of honesty that Anjanette was providing you with in these private conversations?
With all of my research, I like to think of it as a relationship like any relationship I have in my life, which develops slowly and has to be developed with intentions.
You know, I've wrestled for many years with what does it mean to make my life's work about, you know, studying the grief of other people. And how am I going to reconcile that? How am I not going to be a part of this sort of market of grief or this kind of consumption of Black suffering? So I've wrestled with that for years. And I'm not saying that I've come to any kind of definite solutions, but one way I try to deal with that is by asking Anjanette, you know, what do you need right now? You know, what would help? And, you know, when I met with her, she said, look, I'm trying to get my feet off the ground. I need financial stability. I'm in this apprentice program with textiles and sewing. I need a sewing machine. If I had a sewing machine, I'd be able to make handicrafts from home. I wouldn't have to, you know, my PTSD wouldn't be as activated because I'd be working from home in the calm. I wouldn't be interacting with people, which is very triggering for her. That would be very helpful. So she and I set up a GoFundMe page where people can donate to help support, you know, raising the funds for an industrial size sewing machine for her. So that's one way. Another way is, you know, I financially compensate all of my respondents and interviews. And we discuss, you know, what would be a fair kind of, you know, exchange for their time and the emotional distress that recalling these sorts of events result in. I mean, it's not easy to remember the day your son was murdered. So, yeah, and I think I don't shy away from talking about race with my respondents. You know, my mother was from Argentina, my father's Irish, I look white, I come from European descent, and I talk about that. I think one of the most dangerous things you can do as a white researcher is to not talk about your race and the ways in which that shapes your everyday experiences. I think that's one of the most insidious ways in which racism works is that white stops being a different category and just becomes the norm. And I think my respondents appreciate that and will joke about it. And then it kind of becomes okay for us to talk about race, which remains a very taboo subject.
What have you learned from your research about the degree to which support from the public, a kind of public embrace, because, for example, in this case, the number of media appearances which did elicit sympathy for Anjanette through the media from the public, whether that acknowledgement by the public of one's loss translates in some way to being supported by society in other ways, like, for example, financially?
I think more often than not, those kinds of public forms of memorialization are kind of symbolic and nothing more. It's very rare that the public embrace of this sort of tragedy actually results in material support, particularly long-lasting support. You know, people might give donations and people might say their condolences, and that's all well and good. But at the end of the day, Anjanette is still a poor Black woman living in the inner city, and she was that before her son was killed. And where is everybody when she can't find a job? And so I think that we have to resist the affective pull that these sorts of episodic moments, these flare-ups of violence have on us, and to make commitments to communities that we care about to be there through, you know, when the tragedy occurs and well after, and hopefully before. Because I think, you know, it's easy to understand violence with a capital V when it results in the murder of a child, but violence happens in small ways every single day. Whether it's the violence of being underfed, right? Not having quite enough to eat, or living in a house that is inhabitable in many ways, or just living in a racist world, in a patriarchal world. I mean, I think if we can become or create a more nuanced and subtle understanding of what constitutes violence and begin allowing ourselves to dream of, you know, a world without it, I think that's one of the saddest things I encounter in the field is that mothers don't generally say, like, I want to live in a world without violence. It's more, I want, at best, they'll say, I want more police around to stop it when it happens. Or I want, you know, the fact that my son was violently murdered to be acknowledged. Even the possibility of raising children, you know, free of those kinds of threats just is so far away. And I think that's violence for me. That's where I think the real intervention has to happen in, you know, doing the kind of work that inspires and invites people to dream of how they truly want things to be aspirational as opposed to reactive.
So you were saying that Anjanette, the mother, she avoided talking about race and racism and institutional racism in front of the media in her public appearances because she was worried that people would get the wrong impression, or I should say that it would alienate people and they wouldn't come forward with the sympathy and support that she certainly was hoping from the public. What about, for example, you mentioned the Reverend J.C. Jackson and Minister Louis Farrakhan coming and giving her some financial support, some much-needed financial support. They also spoke publicly about Darian's murder. Did they invoke race? And if so, how did they do it? And what did Anjanette think of that?
You know, the Darian's murder occurred in 2009, which was a very different political moment. You know, it was before Black Lives Matter, which has proven to be an incredibly effective movement around, you know, putting racism on the center stage of national discourse. So yes, Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, they spoke about race, but in these kinds of tangential ways. You know, they'll say things like, stop killing our babies, right? And the "our" is the African-American community. But that's not said explicitly. So, you know, if you're not at the actual rally where the speech was given, or if you're not at the funeral where they spoke those words, you can miss it. You know, the splice on the news media, you know, it suggests inclusivity and universality, which, you know, goes hand in hand with neoliberal multiculturalism, which insists that race is no longer an issue. And so it kind of... And that's a strategy on their parts as well, right? Because they want exposure and they want to be seen and heard by as many people as possible. But I think in doing the kind of more grassroots door-to-door kind of activism that they're doing, it's very important for them to acknowledge that, you know, they first and foremost support and represent the African-American community.
Ina Kelleher is her name, and she is a PhD student in comparative ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And again, we've been talking about a paper that she presented at the annual conference of the National Association for Ethnic Studies. Her paper, which is also part of her dissertation, is called Policing Memory: The Violence of Making Black Maternal Grief Legible. Ina, pleasure to meet you. Great to talk with you. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.